Last week we discussed the biblical process of providing a vision for your child. Now, you ought to be able to see by now that what we're trying to do here. We're trying to build each week. The first 2 weeks we took, we really focused on, you know, getting stuff out of your life. We now know that we'll never change our children until you, the parent, are willing to change in your life whatever you have to change. And sometimes that's an easy process, sometimes that's a hard process. But this church is here to help you, however that process is in your life. We're here to work you through those situations. We talked last week about how important it is for your child to have a vision. We basically went to three passages last week, and I hope now that you have those on 3x5 cards and you're working throughout the week with it, because I told you that this concept was the anchor. Everything we do from this point on, and basically everything you do as a parent, is going to come back to what we talked about last week and the aspect of a vision. Remember we went to Proverbs chapter 29, verse 17, and I talked about where the Bible says, where there is no vision, the people perish. And we looked at the verse before that, I believe it's verse 17, and we saw the context. The context is your children. And we saw how important it is that you provide that vision for your child. Then we went over to Habakkuk chapter 2, and we talked about there how that you teach that vision, how you make the child understand the vision, how you make it plain to them, what your job is entailed, how that you focus on keeping that vision before them. Then we went to Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 17 through 25, and we talked about how that you're to constantly reinforce that vision, that concept. We talked about the vision is not of what your child is going to do for God. We've got to get that out of our mind. The vision is about what your child is going to be for God. And today I want to take the next step. We're going to talk today about a number of things, but one of the things that I want to focus on today is something that I've used in my life. If you're going to work with me in the counseling ministry, it's very important that you grasp this today. It's very very much an essential tool in dealing with people. But we're basically going to talk about and begin to focus on for the next couple of weeks the six absolute principles for biblical parenting. And we're going to talk about that today. Obviously, we're not going to get through all of them today. We'll try to get through the first one and we'll go from there. When moms and dads work together to put these areas in their lives on a consistent basis. Remember last week we talked about the things that have to change about you. You have to come to the place when your life as a parent, and it's also true in your husband and wife relationship, but certainly when it comes to parenting, you're going to have to understand that it takes correct thinking. It talked about last week, correct treatment, correct teaching, and obviously correct testimony. These are the things that we have to change in ourselves. We have to make sure that we start to look at our child and we see that child as God sees that child. We need to treat that child based on how we see that child. We need to teach that child based on that concept of God's responsibility. Or we have the responsibility before God to teach him. And then obviously, we talked about that we're the role model for our children. We have to have correct testimony. When you put that with a vision, we're going to develop this concept of vision every week as we go. When you put that with a vision, it forms the basis of that child's core value system. Remember the first week we talked about Daniel and we showed you what you're up against with your child against that evil day? How that the world has a whole daily diet for your child. And we talked about how that Daniel, chapter 1, Daniel, when he was faced with all of this, the Bible says that Daniel purposed in his heart that he was not defile himself with the king's meat. Daniel had a value system. It doesn't tell you who, it doesn't tell you how, but God shows you in the Daniel chapter 1 that when Daniel, much like your child, went up against a day when his parents weren't there, he had nobody to instill in him what was right. What was done in his life was all that he was going to have to hang on to, and it was enough. Somebody had built a core value system in his life that when he was faced with the world, Nebuchadnezzar, all the ungodliness of Babylon, He said to himself, I'm not going to turn against God. That is the core value system I'm talking about building into your child at this early stage. And of course, this is so important when it comes to understanding the process of training up a child. And remember, I talked about how that you don't raise children, you raise rabbits. You don't grow children, you grow corns and beans. You train children. Children will be exactly as the arrows are in the hands of a mighty man, the Bible says, so are children of the youth. And your children will only be a mirrored image of what you are in your own personal relationship with God. That's why you have to change about you what needs to be changed before you can really change your child. Now, in the process of your child growing up physically, as you train them, and remember now, Habakkuk chapter 2 said that you and I are to stand on a wall, on a tower, for a watch. And as you watch your children grow up physically, and you are part of their everyday life and the growing process that they go through, you're going to find that your child goes through four stages. And these stages are absolutely crucial. Now, this has nothing to do with the six biblical principles as far as being part of them. It's just another area that we've got to look at. And it's very important that you understand them. Now, these four stages aren't just like this one comes in and it stops and then this one starts and it stops. No, they build on each other. They build on each other and they bring you to a point that in the process of applying the six biblical principles as a parent in training up your children, it all works together. Now, the first stage your child is going to get into, and these ages aren't exact. I mean, they're just approximate. Every child is different, but it gives you the understanding. The first stage your child is going to get into is going to be the discipline stage. And this stage is going to run from about, 6 months, when time he's born, when he starts moving around, up to about two and a half years, somewhere in there. It could be less or more, depending on the child. But it's in this stage that you begin to see the test of authority. It's in this stage you begin to establish. And to me, this is the most important part. This is the time in your child's life when, with you and him, you get the least done, but it's the most important part, as far as I'm concerned, of laying a foundation in his life, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But this is where you begin to see the test of authority. And the next stage is the relationship stage, and this will run us from the end of the discipline stage whenever, and this stage will go up to about 9, 10, maybe 11 years old. Now, on the end of the discipline stage and the beginning or the middle of the relationship stage, this is where you see and you find the test of your will versus the will of your child. And you have mellow children, you have strong-willed children, and everything in between. There's no rule of thumb because every child is different. And we're going to talk about breaking your child's will at another point when we get into how to discipline your child. But once you get into the relationship stage, now this is where you can begin to really, and you build this on the discipline stage, this is where you begin and have the ability to communicate that vision. You know, a child from 6 months and a year and a half, you can't really reason with them much. But when they get into this stage, this is where, as a parent, building on the discipline stage, which we're going to look at here as we come through these six parenting principles, this is where you get some work done. This is where your child can understand what you're saying as they move through this. This is where your child comprehends principles. And this is where you as a parent really begin to build a relationship with your child through communication, dialogue, things you talk about. Then the next stage is the fellowship stage. And this is the stage that runs from, the end of the other one, 10 or 11, depending on, maybe even 9, I don't know. Every kid's, like I said, is different. But certainly up to about 13 or 14, maybe even 15 years of age. And this is where now, if you've done your work on the on the discipline stage and the relationship stage, this is where you really begin to transfer over the relationship they have with you to a relationship they should have with God. This is a very vital point. Because at the end of the relationship stage and the beginning of the fellowship stage, this is where we have that all-important time in your child's life, which we call the age of accountability. What I mean by that, this is where your child needs to be saved. And we're going to have a whole session on how to win your child to Christ, what to look for. We're not going to get into it today because it'll take us, I want to take plenty of time, but I got to lay all this material down. But I want you to be able to understand, you know, that this is a time where you can begin to really build a relationship with God, with them. But at the same time, this is probably the worst stage of your child's life in all of their growth. This is where they're not an adult yet, but they're not a child anymore. This is where their hormones start to kick in. This is where they begin to change emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And this is where your child can turn into a three-headed monster. And he's not an adult yet, and they're not a child anymore. And they're caught in that vacuum between the two. This is where they can develop a bad self-image of themselves. And rightly so. Their nose and their ears are bigger than the rest of their body. They're not proportioned yet. They're still catching up. Certain parts of their bodies are catching up with the rest of their body. This is where a girl will not want to go out with her friends because she's got that much body and that much leg. This is where guys don't want to go out because they got that much body and that much legs. It's a very confusing time. But it's a time that if you've done your work in the first two, you can bring them through this tough time in a relationship stage, in a fellowship stage. And yet at the same time, this is where you really see the first signs that you're really in trouble as a parent. Up to this point, you can just kind of blow it off as, well, that's just, you know, he's this or he's that. When you get to this stage, you know you're in trouble. This is where you begin to see the warning signs that the evil day has really had an effect on them right here. And it's the time where you can get really the most done, and you begin to build that. You see, you take that discipline stage and you instill the foundation. And then you bring it into the relationship stage where you begin to communicate that vision. Then in the fellowship stage, you begin to really define that vision. You begin to, as your child is dealing with these issues, you incorporate them into everything that you're doing and you walk them through it. Much like I do with you when you come in and you have marital problems or you have individual issues in your life, what I do is basically give you a vision of you don't have to be in this, and then orchestrate, articulate a plan that you can get the victory over it. And on a larger scale, of course, I only work with you once a week. You're living with your children every day. You can get it in a much more personal way and do it in a much greater way. And then we move into around 13 or 14, we move into what we call the responsibility stage. Now, in this stage, if you've done your work as a parent, now you've laid a discipline stage in their life. You've laid a fellowship, a relationship stage in their life. And you've done your homework now and you've laid the good fellowship stage in their life. Now at 14, 15, wherever you're at in here, you work into what we call the responsibility stage. Now your child should have more freedom. They should have more responsibility. This is where you expand their horizon, so to speak. This is where, because you've done your homework, that you don't want to shelter your child anymore, but you want to let them grow through the experience of things within limitations, obviously. But in the problem is, in most cases, because we haven't done our homework in the early stages, this is where I got to put restrictions on them. See? This is where we got to drop the hammer, so to speak. And it's usually that way because we haven't done the work on the other end. If you do your work right and you let me help you with this, and you bring your children and let me work with you, getting your parenting groups, bring along some great questions, really work with you and your husband, talking these things through, begin to develop the vision. If you will basically do these things in your child's life, by the time your child gets to be 15, 16, 17, I'm not saying you won't have some issues. I'm not saying that they won't argue with you about things. But you will now have a strong of 10, 12, 13, 14-year foundation in their life by which you can cash in on when you got to deal with issues. It's just like money in the bank. If your engine blows this afternoon in your car, and you go down to the bank Monday morning and you say, you know what, I blew my engine in my car, I took it over to the shop and it's going to cost me $1,500. So I'd like to get $1,500 to fix my engine. And the lady said, that'd be fine. Can I have your account number? You give her your account number. She goes back there and she comes back in about 10 minutes. She said, we have your account, but you don't have any money on it. And you say, yeah, I know I don't. I went to the boats last week and I was partying and I just blew my money. You got to see the fishing rod I got. Boy, I got the nice 870 Winchester pump shotgun you ever saw in your life. And I got all this great stuff. Yeah, I haven't put any money in the bank. She's going to say, well, you know what? I can't give you any money. She says, what? This is the bank. You got all kinds of money. Well, I saw that guy down here. You just gave him $2,000. I only need $1,500. She said, you don't understand. He brings money in every week and puts it in his account. He's got a lot of money in his account. You don't have anything in yours, see? Now, that's the problem. There's come a day that your child's going to write a check. And you better make sure that 13, 10, 12 years before that, you put the money in the account to cash that check. And if you haven't put anything in, don't let it be a surprise why you can't deal with your child. And unfortunately, in many cases, you're going to lose your child. It's just that simple. I mean, I don't know what you don't understand about that answer, but that's just the way that it is. By this time, if you've done your discipline and your relationship and your fellowship, now your child begins to fully understand. The vision's been fully developed. You're now your child's best friend. There's nobody on planet Earth that's going to have more influence on your child than you are because you put the money in the bank. And you'll cash those checks and that child will take that from that point on in life, the responsibility stage, and take it all the way through. You know what? It's just like you and me in our relationship with God. And I told you when we started this, it didn't make any difference if you don't have any children. These principles are the same principles that if you're just a Christian wanting to be a good Christian, they're the same principles for you. When you got saved, the Bible says you laid a foundation in your life. When you lay that foundation in your life, that's the day you got saved. The Bible says you build upon that foundation, or I should say you should build upon that foundation. Three things, 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Gold, silver, precious stones. Gold represents who God is. So the first thing you want to do when you get that foundation laid is you want to find out who God is. Find out everything you can about Him. That's why we have discipleship here. That's why I'll meet with you once a week, an hour a time. I'll help you. I'll put people into your life if you struggle with things. We have people right now who are struggling with issues in their life that I have two or three teams of guys or gals, whatever the case, go over to their house throughout the week and teach them, work through them. Hey, we're trying to put some money in the bank with you. And it's just that simple. It's a natural process. When you begin to learn who God is by gold, then silver represents the redemption of Christ. You learn what Christ has done for you. When you build upon that foundation, it's a natural process. You can't get it in a book other than this one. You don't got to go to somebody's seminar. You don't have to spend $1 million for somebody's tapes. You just simply get saved and start following the basic, fundamental concept of God building Himself into your life. It takes care of itself. Same way with your child. You got to have a great relationship with God this morning if you have one, because you spent the time in a discipline factor, you changed about your life, in a fellowship factor, in a relationship factor, and now some of you are leaders in this church because you now have responsibility factor in your life. Same system. Exact same system. You build into your life what you build into your life. And you know what? And that's very important. Now, by the time your child is 14, 15, or 16, you pretty much know where you're at. Daniel chapter 5 has always been a favorite chapter of mine. It really... It has nothing specific to do with parenting. It just pretty much deals with everything in life. It's a great chapter where we always use the phrase, the handwriting on the wall. Nebuchadnezzar's over there sitting down there and he's having a good old time, and suddenly there appears over on the wall a hand, and that hand writes on the wall and it gives Nebuchadnezzar a message. So we use from that, you know, the old cliche in the world, you know, well, the handwriting's on the wall, you know, that comes out of Daniel chapter 5. Well, the bottom line is this. By the time your child is 12, 13, 14, and 15, the handwriting's on the wall. You know now where your child is at. You may have been under a delusion that it was just part of his, you know, but by the time he's 14 and 15 and 16, let me tell you something. If your child has no interest in God whatsoever, no interest in coming to church, if they're lazy around the house, lethargic is the classical word, lazy is the Koine. If they're lazy, if they have no motivation, if they do bad in school, if you have to light a fire under them to get them to do anything around the house, and it always breaks into an argument. If your child is like this, you can get along with them until you have to deal with them on an issue. Oh, you let them do whatever they want to do, and you'll say, oh, isn't he the sweetest? Isn't he the sweetest? They're just fine. The moment you have a problem and you have to drop the hammer of authority, you get into a fight, see? I mean, that's just the way it works. That's just the way it works. And by now, you know, if you can't get them to do anything around the house except what they want to do, and you begin to see that they begin to start buying into the world, and you begin to realize you have absolutely no control over them, and you start to see your child begin to look, talk like the world. I mean, it's just that simple. They begin to do all the crazy things that they do. And they begin to go through all of the things, and they come home, and suddenly it's not your little child anymore. They're somebody you never saw before. Now they start to focus on some of the stupidest stuff in all of the world. And of course, by now you need to understand. I know in your heart of hearts you want to cling to the fact that they're probably going to be okay, and they're even probably saved. Truth of the matter is, the reality is, they are probably not. Let me tell you something. You can kid yourself all you want. You can absolutely kid yourself, rationalize yourself, come up with all kinds of excuses. And boy, we do today. We have all kinds of... When I went to school, the teacher never got blamed for anything. I remember one time I had a fifth grade teacher that didn't like me. I mean, knowing me when I was in the fifth grade, it was probably a good choice on his part. He was a math teacher. I was terrible in math. I hated math. I barely got through general math. Algebra, trigonometry, I know nothing about those things. I don't care to know those things. If I'd have known what I know now, I wouldn't even have got general math. If I'd have known that someday they were going to make calculators, I'd have quit school in the sixth grade. He didn't like me. He did not like me. He singled me out. He flunked me in general math. I had to go to summer school between the sixth or seventh grade, whenever it was, because he flunked me. I went home and told my parents. I went home and told them that when they were upset about me being flunked, I went home and I said, he doesn't like me. Mom, he picks on me. Dad, he singles me out. You know what my parents told me? Well, I'll tell you what parents do today. First they do is run down to the school and blame the teacher. See? My parents looked at me and said, Bob, you know what? In life, you're going to have teachers like that and people in their life all your life. So you better start to deal with it right now. Because if you don't, you're going to be in the sixth grade so long, the kids are going to bring you the apple. They're going to think you're the teacher. But we ain't going down. Because, son, in life, there's hard knocks. And if I run down there and fix this problem for you, I'll be running around. And you know what you do when you do that? You give your child the victim status. And oh, we like the victim status today. The thing you cannot take away from your child in its early days is personal accountability. And that's what we like to do. We like to say, oh, it can't be my little child. Got to be the teachers. And when it ain't the teachers, we say, you know, hey, I was a terrible student. If I was a child today like I was back then, I would be diagnosed with what they call ADD or ADS, depending on who you talk to. I would have a definite syndrome problem. My attention span was incredibly bad. I looked out the window. I looked here. I daydreamed. I was not a great student, but if they would have given grades for daydreaming, I would have been valedictorian of the class. I was terrible. Absolutely terrible. My parents never allowed me, never took the teacher aside. My parents went down to the teacher, and the teacher said, "You know what? He can do the work. He can do the work. He doesn't want to do the work. He wants to daydream all the time. He wants to look out the window. He doesn't want to pay attention. He can do the work." It wasn't any of this thing, "Well, he's got this sickness, you see. He's got this deficiency." Where was that in the 1950s? How did I miss that? Where was that in the 1940s? Where was that in the 60s? How come that comes into the end of the age when everybody wants to take in everything in life the accountability factor out? And you want to be a victim. You want to make your poor little boy or little girl a victim, don't you? Yeah, the only thing they're going to be a victim of is their parents when they're burning in the lake of fire. That's their victim status. It's ridiculous. You don't want your child to get on drugs out there off the street, so you put him on legal drugs down there with a doctor, won't you? And you think it'll fix him. I had a lady one time actually tell me this. She said to me, "Well, don't you think back in the apostles' times that they gave their people herbs to help them with their anxiety?" I said, "You got to be kidding me." We've come to the place in our world today where the number one issue is, whether it's children or adults, we don't want to keep them accountable. And we want to take that from them and make them victims of this society. You never help your child. I'm not saying you don't protect your child from some things, but choose your battles. You don't want to protect, you don't want to always take your child's side. You want to, and I'm not saying there's time that you don't, but you want to make sure that, I promise you, your child is not the innocent little angel it appears to be while they're sleeping. And you've got to have an accountability system in that, built into that. By the time your child is 14 and 15 and 16, you're going to see. You're going to understand you have lost your child. And this idea that he's saved or she's saved is an illusion because you don't want to deal with the truth. You won't deal with the reality that that little child growing up who did not have any good example of God or the Bible, suddenly, some way in there, got saved. You're nuts! You're absolutely out of being in an insane asylum this morning. That child is exactly what the parents made him to be, and if he's 14, 15, 16 years old, and you want to hold on that he's saved, when he hates God, he hates the church, he wants nothing to do, you're smoking something, man. You have failed all through your life to take the step that you could. And now you still won't. And you're in this opium pipe dream that he got saved somewhere along the line with ungodly parents, an ungodly mother, an ungodly father, or in a bad situation of a divorce. And you just think that, oh, it's okay. You're wrong. You do greatly err not knowing the scriptures. Sometimes we just don't want to deal with reality. The wisest man that ever lived said in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 1, "Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when I shall say, I have no pleasure in them." And if you don't do it then, there comes a day when they say, "I now do have pleasure in them." I thought of this last night. We were playing softball. The ump made a call. Nobody liked the call that he made. Personally, I think he made the wrong call too. I heard your foot hit when the ball hit the glove. Maybe your foot, you got big feet, maybe your foot just a tad before the ball hit. He called you out, didn't he? Did I run over and say, "No, he's safe"? Did he run over and say, "No, I'm safe"? No, you know why? Because the bottom line is, tough luck. He's the ump. I can think he was safe. He can think he was safe. And when the ump says you're out, you're out. Doesn't matter what you and I think about it. He's the authority. You can have the pipe dream all your life. Your kid's safe, 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 safe. And he lives like hell and does what he wants to do and doesn't care about God. Hey, it's your dream. Smoke it and go on. And I'm sorry if I get a little upset about this, but those little kids down there and some of the kids in your family that I see have the great potential, but some of you won't get off your rear end to do what's right, bothers me. And I think it's a crying shame that I get more upset about it than you do. But then I get paid for it. I get paid for caring about your kids when you don't. That's my job. See? And I'm sure I'll make somebody mad about this, what I said, but you know what? Like Jesus said one time, have I become your enemy because I told you the truth? Always something you can do. Now we're going to begin today to look at what I call the six principles in parenting. Or six types of parents. Now all these will be incorporated into your vision for your child, and these are absolute. These are absolute. When I began a church 4 years ago, and I've been in the ministry a lot longer than that, I knew, and I've given to you these before, the two greatest principles that you can have in your life if you're building a church, the two greatest principles you can have in dealing with people, and certainly the two greatest concepts you can have in understanding the six principles of parenting are found in John chapter 1, verse 17. And it's a verse that you wouldn't think had anything to do with raising your children or training up your children. It's a verse that you wouldn't even think had anything to do with building a church. But it's the greatest principle for your life and my life. And it simply says this. It says, for the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. Now that's a great principle. Probably one of the greatest principles in all of the New Testament for us. When Jesus Christ came, obviously the law is done away with. And God, when God's Son came, He come bringing grace and truth. Now, it's very important. When you understand correct thinking, correct treatment, correct teaching, and correct testimony in dealing with your children, then you're going to see how the grace and truth has to impact into this. And it's one of the greatest single truths in all of ministry, in all of pastoring, and certainly in all of parenting. Now, truth. Let's talk about truth. Truth is a standard that we hold. Truth is what we believe. Truth, in our case, is a King James 1611 authorized version. Truth for us is the Bible. We have the truth. We know we have the truth. We're not concerned that we don't. We absolutely know that the Bible is the... You hear me say it all the time. The Bible is the absolute final authority in all things in faith and practice. Faith being your salvation, practice your daily life. We believe that. But then you got to have grace. Now, truth is what you believe about the Bible, but grace is how you use the Bible that you claim to believe. And this is where the problem comes in churches. We should do what we do in truth. But you can be truthful in the wrong manner and have no grace. I think of the crazy idiot up in Topeka, Kansas. You've heard me say this before. Fred Phelps. Fred Phelps is one of the... I wish he would not call himself Baptist, but he does. Fred Phelps is the guy in Topeka who has got some serious mental problems. His idea of the ministry and the gospel is going to funerals where somebody's been killed in Iraq and then holding up signs in front of the grieving family that your son's burning in hell, ha ha ha, God hates this, God hates that. He's the guy that takes a radical stand on just about everything in life and, has gotten national publicity out of it, but not in a positive sense. Now, you know what the tragedy is about all of this? In a lot that he says, he's correct. It's just the way that he goes about doing it. I believe that a lot of the boys killed in Iraq or Iran in the Middle East have died and went to hell. But I think it's a terrible thing. You don't see me going around gloating it and making their parents feel bad. That's the wrong way. That is absolutely no grace. If I was in a given situation like that, I would reach out to those families. I would love them. I would have enough spiritual perception to know that if the boy was lost, and obviously we don't know if he was it or not, but let's face it, let's be honest, we know that they're all not. I would hope I would have enough understanding of truth and grace that I would recognize that we maybe lost the boy, God forbid, but you can still reach out and get the family. And the way you reach out to the family is not blasting truth in their face, hey, your boy's in hell. It's reaching out with grace and saying, we love you and we want to be here for you and we at this church, I as your pastor will do whatever I can do for you. That's the balance. That's the balance. And of course, we don't have that today in churches. I think of it in our own Baptist mindset. You know, I get classified all the time of being against Christian schools. I'm not against Christian schools. I just think real Christian schools ought to be in homes. I think that real Christian school starts at home. I think when you subcontract your child out to an organization, no matter who it may be, to substitute you as a parent in their training, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. And I think when that happens, I think many, many times, you know, it becomes a very bad situation. Because they get caught into a situation where there's a lot of truth, but there's no grace. And it becomes a bad deal. Bad deal. I got a friend of mine that's in the ministry, and I love him dearly, and I've several guys that I know. And yet, when they train young men or they turn young men out, there's a guy in this town. I wouldn't name him for anything in the world, but he you find him downtown on the plaza all the time with a little group of robots, and they're down there, and everything they do is just absolutely tearing people down. I'm not against street preaching, but I think street preaching truth without God's grace is a disaster. I told you about the time I was preaching up in Boston, and a pastor picked me up, and he said, "Let's go out to eat tonight." And I knew this guy was a real legalistic type of guy, and I knew he was kind of off that fringe side, but all right, you invited me up, maybe I can do some good. Well, we go to eat, and then we're driving around downtown Boston on a Saturday night. You ever been in Boston downtown on a Saturday night? There's a lot of people down there. Now, this guy's got a CB in his car with a hand-control mic, and he's got a PA system underneath the hood. And we're stopped at a street light, and two good-looking girls go across the street, probably just going wherever. He starts calling them whores and says, "You're going to hell, and God knows where you're going tonight." They look at me. Yeah, me. He's got the mic, but they look at me. I went... every stoplight, he would nail the people going across the street with some of the stuff that and then at the next stoplight, he says to me, "Hey, this is great, isn't it, brother? Here." I said, "Here what?" He says, "You try it for a while. It's a blast." I took the mic and said, "Parks, line one," and hung it back to him and said, "I'm done." That's ridiculous. You can't do that with people. That's truth without grace. And of course, there's no greater place for balance of grace and truth than in obviously the ministry, but in our study today, in parenting and in your family in general. Now, the six principles on parenting are built around grace and truth. Two of them fall on the truth side. Four of them fall on the grace side. I'm going to list all six, and then we're going to come back and we'll talk about them, and we won't get through them today, but we'll start with them. First of all, you have on the six principles, you have authority. Then the second one is accountability. Then the third one is affection. The fourth one is availability. The fifth one is appreciation. And the sixth one is acceptance. Now, the first two, authority and accountability, fall on the truth side. Number 3, 4, 5, and 6 fall on the grace side. And I want to begin to take that and begin to show you how you use these six principles. But you got to have grace and truth. You got to have a balance in your life. And, you know, now first of all, we have authority and accountability. Your child, you as a parent, have to know truth because you are their only source, or really their primary source of truth. That'll be their authority. I told you last week how that in that young child, you are God in their life. They don't understand God. They understand you. You image God to them through your testimony and through your life. They find God or do not find God basically in you. As you come up through those four stages, then obviously when you get into the fellowship stage, you transfer that to God and teach them how to have their own relationship. Just like I do with you when you come to see me. You as a parent must know truth because you are the only, or as I said, the primary source of truth. You're not the only source, but you are the primary source. But within truth, within that truth, you need to provide boundaries and limitations for your children. That'll be accountability. Now, those are your two first issues. You have to provide truth for your child, that's authority, but at the same time, you have to put boundaries in your child's life, that will be accountability. And of course, this is where we have the problem today. Your child needs an authority system and an accountability system, but it needs to be balanced with grace. When you get into affection, availability, appreciation, and acceptance, these four form the basis of how you give truth and how you establish the authority and the accountability through grace. A balance of grace and truth through the four concepts when you change yourself about correct thinking, correct treatment, teaching, and testimony. In other words, it is the grace that you have with the truth that you have that you get the vision instilled in their life. That's so important. Now, you and I as parents, you have to provide limitations for your child. They have to have an authority system and an accountability system. And so that when he hits that evil day or she hits that evil day, that they have a core value system built into their life. And this is what this goes back to the vision of last week. This is what you are basically putting into their life on a vision concept. As he moves through these four stages, you as a parent keep redefining the vision. You make it in a more detailed way. You make it more understandable as he can grasp it. And you just keep bringing it back. And every time you have to deal with an issue, you continue to reinforce that concept. You know, I've found over the years, and I've been in this business a little while now, and I've seen just about every mistake that a parent can make. I've made a lot of mistakes as a parent. I'm not certainly going to stand up here and tell you that I'm a perfect parent. There is no such thing as a perfect parent. But there are parents who want to use the Word of God and will do the best they can with what God provides for them. And I say it again, I'm not castigating anybody up here. I don't have anybody in mind when I do this, you know. There's a tendency when you work with people, you know, and you deal with people, that sooner or later one of your specific areas are going to cross something I say. So you're sitting back there saying, well, he just singled me out. No, I'm really not. And probably this. If I've met with you at least 2 weeks ago, beyond 2 weeks ago, I don't remember what we talked about. I mean, I have ADD. I don't think that far back. I don't catalog it. I got other things I'm trying to think about, you know. And so I'm not castigating anybody. I'm here to help you. And I don't care where you're at. I don't care what mistakes you've made. I say it all the time. You just can't grasp this. Wherever you're at, whatever mistakes you made, you can start to turn the corner if you want to. But it's up to you. Up to you. But I'm just telling you. Now, over the years, I've seen four basic types of parents. Or four basic types of parenting, I guess. And all of you in here are in one of these four. Now, sometimes you find mixtures of these four because everybody's different. But basically, if you would boil it down, get all the stuff off the top, you'd come up with four different styles of parenting with variations where some of you have some mixed characteristics, but this is what you got. And if you're going to be in counseling with me, you need to learn these. And you need to learn how to identify these. Because the first thing when you start dealing with parents when they're problems, that I do anyhow, is in a mental mind, put the parent in where they're at by what they say or what I learn from them. That helps me help them better. I mean, bottom line is, to solve a problem, you have to know the problem, right? So when you sit down to me and you throw up all over my upstairs coffee table and you just get it all out, what you've done besides make a gigantic mess in my upstairs room is you've given me what I know now where you're at. And I can better help you. I can better help you. Now, the first type of parent is what I call autocratic. Autocratic. That simply means my way or the highway. An autocratic parent will say to their child, do it because I said so. An autocratic parent will not have any discussion about anything. There'll be no debate. There'll be no reasoning. They're a very strict disciplinarian without any explanation. There's absolutely no grace involved with an autocratic parent. It's like your child is under some kind of Old Testament law. Now, you see this a lot, and I deal this with a lot with kids that have come out of a Christian school or kids, people who find themselves in very legalistic churches. And I guess I need to address this just for the sake of, so you all know where I'm coming from. Now, oh gee, where do I start with this? I grew up in a church back in Ohio, back in the 70s. And the issue in the 70s was long hair. It really was the 70s and even the 80s. I know most of you, some of you remember this, but most of you don't remember hippies. We remember hippies. That's how you met. You met her at Woodstock, didn't you? Didn't Sonny meet you at Woodstock? These guys don't know what Woodstock is. You know, they think Woodstock goes on a rifle. There was hippies. Now, hippies are in with brontosauruses and tyrannosaurus rexes in the museum, okay? But hippies were long-haired, unclean, unkept, and they basically were making a statement against any established authority. And the hippie movement was a situation where, you know, churches reacted to it. There were Baptist churches back then who had standards. Now, I'm all for standards. Don't misunderstand me. I have standards. But if a guy didn't wear the right clothes when he came to church, I know in our own church, and I was nobody back then, I was just a young Christian, I didn't have any say anything, but I watched them meet people who, I watched a young couple one time, he had hair as long as she did, she had bell bottoms on with a midriff, back then was, you know, was terrible, and, you know, he had long clothes with patches on it, and he had American flags sewed on his rear end, you know, I mean, and I watched them be met at the door by two deacons and told them they couldn't come to church till they dressed right. Now, you know, that's a terrible thing. And you know what? That happened all across the country in churches. And you know what? Those same people today are the leaders of our country in Washington today. That same mindset. And how many times they went to churches, in my church back home, if your hair touched your ear. I remember in our basketball league and our softball league, they would go up to guys and you'd be out. You'd be done. They'd look at you and they'd say, out, you can't go. See? That's terrible. I remember watching them do that. And, you know, and I, as a young guy, I thought that was the right thing to do until I grew up a little bit and thought how stupid it was. Because I grew up and I saw the fallacy of legalism. Now, you go to some Baptist churches today and ladies, I mean, you wearing camouflage pants to church is an absolute sin. Now, we called them pedal pushers when I was growing up. What do they call them now? Capris. Boy, how things change. See, they were pedal pushers when we grew up, remember? Yeah. That's when I used to chase her down the street on her bike and she was pushing them pedals. Terrible. You know? And there's some churches that if you ladies wear slacks to church, you're in trouble. I mean, they'll throw you out. Or they'll look at you real strange. Now, I learned something a long time ago. On hair, I woke up one day. I watched a guy preach one time, and he was preaching on, and I was behind him. I was a pastor then. And I was sitting on the pulpit, and he's preaching on against long hair. And he was railing on him. He was railing on him. And when he worked into a sweat. And when he was done preaching, he turned around, and his hair was just, he was sweaty. He was sweating through his suit. His hair, I mean, he looked like he just stepped out of the shower. I mean, weren't around to me, his hair was all messed up. And it was down in his face, down through here and down through there. And at that moment in my life, I understood the great principle. It wasn't long hair was wrong. It was the placement of long hair that was wrong. I got it. That is a long hair. Split it down the middle and put it over, and God in heaven goes, take that same long hair, run it over this way, that way, this way, or this way, God goes. So in that moment of time, I defined a great truth for me. It wasn't long hair that was wrong, it was the placement of long hair that was wrong. And I got it. Now, don't misunderstand me. I never preach about the clothes you wear. We have women that wear slacks here. We have women that wear capris. We have women that wear... I'm really into the camouflage. I like that. But if you're going to wear camouflage, make sure it matches. The worst thing in the world is camouflage top that doesn't match the camouflage bottom. Camouflage has to match. It has to match. It has to. And I don't ever go after those things. You know what? Here's what I believe. I believe that if I preach the Word of God to your heart, when you love God, whatever you have on this morning, when you dress, whether you're male or female, when you dress to please God in the morning, whatever you have on is going to be just right. No, that's what I believe. You can't legislate morals. You can't. I'll get up here and I'll say, all right, all you women are wearing slacks today, you're all godly, ungodly, and you got to, don't you show up next week wearing slacks, because the Bible says that if a woman wears what pertaineth to a man, back in the Old Testament, it's an abomination. How many ever heard that verse preached? You know what the problem is with that? Now that verse says, if a woman wear what pertaineth to a man, it's an abomination. You know, ladies, if you got a dress on this morning, as far as the Bible's concerned, you're wearing what a man wore back in the Old Testament. See how dumb it is? So then I get up and I say, all right, y'all got dresses on. But some of them are too short. So next week, y'all show up with long dresses. You know what's going to happen? One of you ladies is going to go out and buy a long dress. And it's going to be so tight, look like a skin diver suit. So the next week I get up and I say, it's got to be long, and now it's got to be loose. You know what's going to happen? Somebody's going to go out and buy one that's long and loose, that's so thin a mosquito can fly through without breaking a wing. So next week I got to get up and I say, now it's got to be long, it's got to be loose, and it's got to be thick. You can't legislate morals. You preach to a person's heart. You can't put people under a law. You can't. And the autocratic parent many times represents the autocratic church. Well, it's my way or the highway. And I'll tell you what happens in that. I've seen pastors, because a kid didn't dress right, ridicule him in front of those kids, the rest of the kids. I've dealt with it many times in my life where the kid came in with the best that he had. The pastor had no ability to see past his clothes, to see the kid's heart. All he couldn't see the fact that the kid came. All he could see is he didn't meet the standard. And then he ridiculed that boy or girl, and that boy or girl never went back. You know John Dillinger? You know who John Dillinger was? John Dillinger was one of the greatest gangsters of the 20s to the 30s all down through the Midwest and Chicago. You know the story behind John Dillinger? John Dillinger, the young child, lived on the other side of the tracks in Indianapolis, Indiana. And he went to church one day as a young boy wanting to learn about God. And because he didn't wear the clothes that he should have had, and because he was the wrong side of the family, an old deacon and an old deacon's wife met him at the door and made fun of Johnny and said, don't ever come back to this church again until you can wear some right clothes. Made fun of him in front of the kids, and he went out that door and said, I'll never go back to church again. You know where he went? He went and became John Dillinger. Don't get me started on it, because we'll never get to the first point. Nothing infuriates me about churches and pastors than setting up some idiotic standard that has nothing to do with the Bible whatsoever. Teach the people to love God with all of their heart, with all of their mind, and all of their soul, and everything else will take care of itself. It's just that simple. And in most cases, you have with kids like that what I call in counseling the slingshot effect. They get raised in that. They go to a Christian school. The kids are smarter than the parents. They're smarter than the school system. They know it's phony. They know it's not real. They know it's not. And the moment they get out from under their parents' authority, they slingshot the other way. I don't blame them. I don't know how many times I've helped bring somebody back simply because of the fact I understood that the system that did what they did to them was supposed to be God's system when it was not God's system. Terrible. So autocratic is the first. Then we have what we call the permissive parent. In this type of situation, The parents are so afraid that they'll lose the love of their child, they never really discipline him. And in time, the time the kid gets 12, 13, 14, or 15, it's very obvious who's in control of the family. The child now knows the right buttons to push to get what they want from you. It's very clear now that instead of you training him or her, they've now trained you. And you react to them and you cave in every time. And you think about, oh, my poor little girl, or oh, about my poor little boy, and what's going to happen, and what's going to do this, and your misappropriated love, and your total lack of to enforce or apply truth. In time, your kid turns to be out a fornicating, drinking, pot-smoking, who cares nothing about God, nothing about church. You know what they do? They wind up using God and people in the church just like they use you. That's exactly what they do. And you know what? And this is where they get into all the weird stuff. This is where you actually see Romans chapter 1, which talks about how that when man turns his back on God, he begins to worship the creature more than the Creator. In my day, in 1960 and 70, we have now been almost over a half a century without a Bible. You saw it in the culture. You saw Romans chapter 1 in the music. In my day, all the music groups were named after animals. Yeah, because Romans chapter 1 says that a society without God goes after the creature, not the Creator. So in my days, it was the Monkees, Three Dog Night, the Beatles. It was all dealt with the animals. And everything in the music went that way. In the 80s and the 90s, the digression was already working. We went from the animals, now we're into dead things. Kiss, who looked like demon. Michael Jackson, who looks like Night of the Living Dead, still does. We got the guys killing the chickens on the platform and everybody just having a great time. You see, it's degenerated down. And now today, the music, and it goes farther and farther and farther. Now everything you hear in the music that your child listens to, that he's part of, and the culture, that animalistic culture that he is part of, now talks in every song, in every lyric, it's talking about sex, it's talking about killing a police officer, it's talking about violence, it's talking about hating your mother, hating your father, it's tearing down. We have went from the animals to the dead people, right down the line, where everything, every fiber of that world system in your child that he likes to be part of, this is now where he wears the black clothes all the time. Notice it? Everything he has wants to be black. This is where he starts wearing his cat goofy on the side. This is where they start piercing themselves. I saw a guy the other day that had more stuff sticking out of him. He looked like a porcupine. This is where body piercing. This is where tattoos come in. This is where altering your body other than the way God made it. This is where your purple hair comes in, or your yellow hair, or whatever hair. This is where you want to look like an animal. You want to act like an animal. The society you're in is animalistic. And Romans chapter 1 says that's where it goes. You quit serving the Creator, and now you're worshiping the creature. So you want to look like them. You want to act like them. You'll have their morals. You'll wear their clothes. Your hair will look like them. You'll do everything that the world does, you see. And I heard one time a kid came in and he looked like a you bangy that missed. I mean, he could have went into a sideshow for 25 cents being a freak. And his mother, he walks in and she introduces me to him, and I'm kind of looking at him, you know, saying, I wasn't even sure if he was a guy or a gal. And she walks by me and she says, "Isn't he cute?" And I looked at her and I said, "No, ma'am, that was not my first thought, but thank you. Thank you." That's a permissive parent. They can't deal with it because they're afraid they're going to lose their child. And they've already lost them. Hello? They're not having anything to do with them. They can't have any control over them. And now we find, and I'll tell you the side note. The side note of this is, and I've watched it, this is not true in every case, but boy, it is true. And if you're doing counseling, you always want to look for this. In most of these cases, not every case, this will be brought about in a basic mode, a lot of reasons, but one of the basic things will be a strong-willed mother and a weak father. It'll be a mother who always takes charge of things, or maybe the mother will just have some fearsome, severe issues. And the father either doesn't have the tools with it all to deal with it, or he just gives up and doesn't want to deal with it. But in those cases, it always seems to, not in every case, but that is just a little side note that you want to see. All right, the next one is we have what we call neglectful parents. And we read about these all the time. We read about these that are in a saved situation and in a lost situation. We look at parents that moms and dads just let their kids run wild. How many times we've heard on the news or read in the paper where some mother was out partying, left her 3-year-old at home by all herself for 2 days? Just terrible, tragic things. I mean, this world has absolutely no care for responsibility for the children that we bring into this world. Most of them, many of them, do not even know who the fathers are. And it's just like a zoo. It's just like an absolute zoo. And the parents are so neglectful. They provide nothing whatsoever for their child. No church, no Bible. And yet, there's Christian parents the same way. There's Christian parents that I promise you, the only way their kids ever get to church is if somebody else brings them. And now it's a tragic thing. I mean, it's a tragic thing. You think, and here's the downfall. You think because you stay at home and you send your child to church that you're doing some great service. Oh yeah, I know. You're busy, aren't you? Yes, you are. Oh yes, you got too many things you got to do. Or you got some issue with church. So you're not going to go yourself, but you're going to do the great parenting thing, and you're going to send your child with somebody else. You know how long that'll last? Till they hit the evil day. And then when they don't want to do what's right, they'll look back at mom and dad who didn't want to do what's right. They'll take the value system that you got in your life, and they'll say, you know what? If mom and dad don't go, I ain't going either. That's where that'll end. That's where that'll end. The neglectful parents fall into the category of Lot and Jephthah, selfish and prideful. No accountability for them, no accountability for their children. No real Bible format. You let them do basically whatever they want to do. Or you provide no real structure for them. And it falls into both categories. The side note of this is many times you see a variation of this in parents that are divorced. And it's unfortunate. And we're going to have a whole section on whatever state you find yourself in, because I know some of you this morning are divorced. Some of you are divorced and remarried, and you have kids by another marriage, and that poses its own set of issues. We're going to deal with all of those. I'm going to show you biblically how you handle every one of those scenarios, because people find themselves in different scenarios. I call this one the I'll show you syndrome. And that is the husband or the wife hates the other partner because of what they did to them. And because they can't get past their own issues, the child always pays the price. How many times I've seen a wife want to take her boy or daughter to church, or I've seen the husband want to do it, and in each case, whatever the case may be, the other one works doubly hard to destroy that kid going to church. And you know what? It isn't because she hates the kid, or he hates the kid. It isn't because they don't want the best for their kid. It's because they're selfish and because they're like Lot. They vex themselves with the filthy conversation of this world, and they're so angry at the other parent, they're going to get their own kid to die and burn in hell for eternity just so they can prove a point against their other spouse. Very good. Very good. Congratulations. Mother of the year. Father of the year. It happens all the time. Let me tell you something. Your kid didn't ask to be brought into this world. It was your decision based on you two. You two screw it up. You two mess it up. Don't let the kid pay the price for it. But they will. They will. Then we have the last parent, type of parent, and I call this the relationship parent. These are those who, through their own personal relationship and their own personal growth, have built a great foundation of grace and truth. And now through the vision and the understanding of what they're up against, like we saw in Daniel chapter 1, and they understand their responsibility, they get a really good relationship with that child, and they begin to really balance out the relationship, and they take these six principles. They take these six principles, and they really begin to work them in their child's life. Now, we talked last week about instilling a vision. Let me build onto this for you. Let me put all these pieces together for you, because we're giving you a lot of information here. Let me put it into a concise way of, and when we get into our parenting classes, we'll talk about this and we'll have a better understanding of how to work all this stuff out. And you can ask me one-on-one whenever you want. Right now, let's take the scenario that most of you are in, that you have young children, they're down in the nursery, they're anywhere between birth and, you know, 3 or 4 or 5, 6, maybe 8 years old. Certainly still enough time. And many of you, you know what, you've done the best you could. You've really done a good job not having what you're getting now. I commend you for that. You instilled principles, you instilled discipline, you really have, with what you did know, you did good. But now we've got to begin to get it into the Bible concept. We talked last week how you sit down with that child and you help him understand that vision. You want to help him understand that there has to be things in your life, in his life, that you have to control. And you take them and you help him understand that, hey, look, you know what? I have things in my life I have to control. You use the basic, everyday, ordinary concepts of life that you struggle with. Never with your child do you want to get to the point where he gets the idea that you're down, he's down here, and you're up here, and you don't understand what he's at. Let me tell you something. You and your child have the same issues in life. They're just on two different levels. The failure of parents is they don't understand that. The failure with parents is they don't know how to get down to that level. Hey, you know what? When Jesus, we talked about this last week, when Jesus dealt with anybody in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in his earthly ministry, he never got deep spiritual with them. Did you ever notice that? He talked about things that they could relate with. He says one time, he says, red sky at night, you can discern the sky, but you can't discern. He talked about the sky. From that we get red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky in the morning, sailors take warning. Come out of there, see? He talked about animals. He talked about issues in life. He talked about things like bread and made an analogy. He talked about water, made an analogy. He talked about people being born, made an analogy. When he wanted to reach people, he did it on a level with things that they were with every day in their life that they could understand and relate to. He didn't try to impress, if anybody knew the Bible, he did. He didn't try to impress him with his theological knowledge. He didn't try to overwhelm them and show them how much he knew. He didn't try to talk about things that locked them in the dust. He brought it down to simple, basic terms. You know what makes me successful as a pastor? And this is not because of me. It's just because, you know, I'm stupid enough to be able to see it. But if I have one quality as a pastor that I feel in my life makes me a good pastor, and it's so simple, I don't know. I have the ability to take things that are complicated and bring them down where you can walk out and everybody can understand it. Now, that's not, I don't think that's a gift. Maybe it is, I don't know. I do know this. That's the way I got to deal with things in life. I'm not a very complicated person. I don't understand a lot of things. I'm the guy that when I put a model car together as a kid, or I put an airplane together as a kid, I had a lot of parts left over. After 3 or 4 years, I took all those parts. You want to see the model I made? It flew, it drove, it went underwater, and it went in and flew in the air. To me, I have to understand deep things by breaking them down to the lowest common denominator. And I do that with people. That's why I don't care where you've been. I don't care what you've done. I don't care what problems you've had in your life. Those things are irrelevant to me as long as you want to do what is right now. I'll do whatever it takes. You can have as much time as it takes. I'm not one of these guys that you're down here and I'm up here. I learned through ministry that you have to be one with your people. You can't be better than them. You can't live higher than they do. You can't be aloof from them. They got to have access to you 24/7. They got to be able to come up and touch you and talk to you and ask you questions. They can't think, well, I've got to go through so and so to get the brother Bob. I can't just go talk to him. Or I can't call him on the phone because, you know, he's really busy. Hey, you can call me anytime, day or night. After 12, I take the phone off the hook, so have at it. Call me in the morning. No, I don't take it off the hook. I just never hear it. Come on, beat on the door if you need me that bad. But you know what? That's what you have to do. And I'm saying, if that's what works in ministry, and being able to take something complicated and break it down to a basic format works for you, it'll work for your child. But this is where you got to have a plan. This is where you got to sit down with your husband, or if you don't have a husband or you don't have a wife, come and talk to me. This is where you've got to dialogue and you've got to say, okay, Bob, how can I, this is what the parenting classes are about. How can I do that? When your child comes up against something that he wants that he doesn't get, think of something in your life that you wanted that you didn't get. Bring it down to his level. Make him understand that, as my parents made me understand, he's not a victim because he doesn't get what he wants. We got the idea now that kids have the idea now that if they are 16 or 17 year old and you don't provide them a car, there's something wrong with your parenting skills. That's where it's at. You know why? Because everybody in their school's got one. So what? If everybody in school goes out and commits suicide tomorrow, you're going to encourage your child to do it? I don't care if the whole school does it. If it's not the right thing to do, then don't do it. But if you haven't built the basis with your child by which you can reason that thing through and show him the differences, and that's the problem. That's why right now you have to start with that vision. You have to begin to build the vision, have him understand it. When we get into our parenting classes, we work through those things. We talk about those things, and by the time we get toward the end of this, you as a husband and wife or a single parent, whatever you find yourself in, you now have the wherewithal to sit down and biblically and rightly open up and give that child a vision and then understand how to maintain that vision through those four stages, bringing from the deception. And we're going to talk about them as we get into these six things next week. We're going to talk about how to get that discipline stage, how to get to that fellowship stage, that relationship stage, and right on through those things, the responsibility stage. Your child, if he's 15 or 16 years old and he's living in your home, he ought to be your greatest asset as far as ministry is concerned. They ought to be your greatest asset as far as getting things done around the house. He ought to come to the place now where he, and I'm not saying they have perfect days, but I'm saying he ought to have an appreciation for the fact of, you know what, I'm in this family too. And just like mom and dad goes to work, I have responsibilities that I have to do. Instead of fighting with him to take the trash out, arguing with him about picking up his clothes, doing this or doing that. Why does it have to break into a Pier 6 brawl every time you want to try to get your child to do something that's responsible? You know why? Because we've not trained them to be responsible. That's why. And many times we've aided and abetted them. We've let them live like hell, and yet they come home and they know they got a nice bed to sleep in. We let them live like hell and run like dogs, and yet they come back and you feed them. You see, we just don't get the balance in our lives. And because of that, when we think we're doing good for our child, like I said when we started our second series, many times the parent, we like to talk about the world, the flesh, and the devil, and all the things that they'll do to your children. But many times, the worst enemy your child's got is you, the parent. And when you start to build those things into your life, and you know, and that's the way we want to be around here. We want to have the freedom. We want to have the freedom that you can be who you are in Christ. We don't have any rules and regulations in the sense that legalism, like we talked about today, because I want you to do what you do based on your relationship with God. If somebody comes in here and they don't look right or they don't smell right or they don't talk right, whatever, you know what? I know this is a dying truth. I know that whatever their deficiencies are, and we all got them, if they will just stay with God and let the Word of God do what it's supposed to do, God will fix everything in your world. Not my job. My job is not to look at you and to make a judgment on you. My job is not to look at you and say, well, I like you or I don't like you. My job is to understand that you and me are in the same boat together, and my job is to preach the truth to you. That's my job. My only job. My job is to love you. My job is to be there for you. My job is to hold you up through tough times. My job is to encourage you whatever you do. My job is to help, always help you, never hurt you. But my job, and many times it's the toughest part of my job, is to tell you the truth. I do not do you any favor by allowing you to live in the illusion that you live in. You have to understand, truth is truth. And the first thing we have to do to change our children, change ourselves. And I'm here to help. Next week, we'll begin to move into these six principles and we'll begin to put them into the vision the way they need to be. Now, when we're done this morning, if you want to get into my parenting class, then come over here to my wife and we'll get your name on a list and we'll get that going here in the next week or two. And I'll help you any way I can. If you got your parenting group already set up, that's fine. If you need to get it set up with me. If you're not in a group and you want to have a question about it, come and see me. Or just go sign up with my wife. Also, if you want to sign up your Joshua group, please feel free to come and see me. And if you're going to get baptized, you need to talk to me this morning. And let's have a word of prayer and we'll be dismissed. Thank you for being here today. Rose wants me to tell you that she is absolutely unequivocally not doing any more CDs for those who have not picked up their CDs. So if you haven't picked them up, you're not going to get any more in your stack. Those of you that are faithfully picking them up, you can get them. And if you're a visitor here this morning, I'm going to make you a one-time deal that I won't make again until next week. And you just go tell Rose over there, she's the one holding the baby. I know she doesn't look young enough to have that baby, but she just had that baby yesterday. And she's an amazing woman. You go over, and if you're a visitor here this morning, and or you came last week, I want to give you as a gift all the parenting series up to this point. And you know what? Maybe you won't come back. Maybe I made you mad, or maybe you don't like me, or maybe it was just something the way I looked. And maybe, you know, really, I don't know, maybe just something is wrong. They're not really wrong with me. I don't know what your problem is. But just go tell Rose you'd like to have a set, and we'll get them to you. And we want you to have that as our guest. And I hope you come back. We hope you find a home here. And always know that I'm, as your pastor, or whether I'm not your pastor, it doesn't matter if you join this church or not. If you need me, I'm here for you. And you can come over to my house anytime. After service, I always go back there and book my appointments. You come over to my home, sit down in my office, and we can talk. I'll help you any way I can. I'm here for you. And that's what this church is all about. And let's ask God. Lord, we do thank you.